and they can appear for various loops. For example, if we do, as we saw, if we want to study the propagation of a particle in the presence of a gauge field along some loop C, we will see that we need to compute the expectation value of the Wilson loop on the corresponding contour. A very particularly important and very physical contour is this very high rectangle, where one of the sides T goes to infinity and the other side R is kept fixed. And we saw that the expectation value of the rectangular Wilson loop in this limit where it is infinitely stretched is directly related to the force between two particles. Of course, it's a very interesting probe. If we compute it and we get something like a Coulomb potential that decays with the distance, then the force is going to zero. This is, would be a non-confining theory. Of course, if we would have computed and gotten that potential, that a potential grows linearly with distance, say, we would have a constant force and this would be a sign of confinement. Then we moved ahead and started computing these guys in perturbation theory, where to living order, when we compute this average, all we have to do is we contract the fields that make the Wilson loop. In other words, we just have to sum over exchanges of our photons or gluons, depending if we are studying QED, like in this picture, or QCD or N equals 4 if we are studying non-abelian gauge theories. We saw that there were two classes of important diagrams from a physical point of view. One, which if you want, is the measurable diagram, which is the one that depends on the distance, which is just the exchange of a photon between the two particles, and of course that gives rise to Coulomb potential. And then we saw that there were other diagrams which contain a divergence when two particles approach a lot, when these two photons approach a lot. We have a propagator, 1 over distance squared, we integrate over that, so we get a 1 over distance singularity, and that can happen anywhere in the loop, so we will have a singularity of the form length of the loop times 1 over A, where A is ultraviolet cutoff. And this is a very universal divergence, and in particular in our case, it is of course independent of the distance. It only knows about this edge, it doesn't care about this separation. And then we had a bunch of other diagrams that when T was very large, they were irrelevant. Then we asked ourselves, okay, this is QED or N equals 4 at one loop, because at one loop there's no difference between QED and N equals 4. And we started thinking what could be the way of computing these objects using ADS-CFT. But before I move on, I would like to ask if there is any question concerning the tutorial, because the tutorial was designed to be a complement to understanding these diagrammatics on the one hand and the propagation on the other hand. So it might be a good point if there was something unclear, so try to ask me now. Did you all do the tutorial yesterday? Yeah? Yes? No? Not everyone is saying yes. Did you manage to do the tutorial yesterday? Part of it? No? Almost nothing? Yes?
Yeah, fine. But I have a question for the picture, because, after doing all the algebra, we found that this normal integral of exponential half integral for the field is equal to a set of loops with different total time.
That's right.
Is there a nice graphical interpretation? Can we somehow say that we cover the whole space-time by loops of different length and different orders?
Yes, the graphical picture, you can think exactly in the usual, if you want, Alla Feynman. When you do this first quantization, when you write that a propagator is a sum over paths from one point to the other, then you can really redo your perturbation theory of quantum field theory just in this language. What is a vertex operator now? You sum over paths where the particle with some probability can split into two, and then you have two other paths. And you can literally study the propagation of particle with vertices and loops and so on as summing over paths where the particles split and join and so on. And it just translates directly when you draw a Feynman diagram. Naively you think that this describes a particle that splits into two and then they unite again and so on. The way you do the computation, you integrate over these vertices and that's it. It's a very practical way of doing it. But if you use this language of each propagator, you do the tricks that we did, then you would write it's an integral over all paths that go from this point to this point. Then there are paths that split into two. One path goes here, the other path goes there. And you really write, you can write all your perturbation theory in quantum field theory in this first quantized language where you really only speak of particles going along paths. A very physical description, which you thought to exist, and it's as simple to derive it. You just follow exactly the same kind of simple tricks that we did when we started the single propagator. So all the propagators that you would draw to compute the free energy, you would draw bubbles and so on, can be interpreted literally. They really describe sums over paths of virtual particles. They are really, you create a virtual particle that goes anywhere and is annihilated and so on. So all those pictures with propagators and so on, they can be written in a way that really look like summing over histories, like the way we like to think of quantum mechanics.
But then in the second part, we did it for gluons, but with this particle picture, you have the mass there.
Right, so for, yeah, okay, so when we did a when we did this language of summing over paths, there is the mass, but the mass came after eliminating the hindbind. If you remember, we discretized, and then it was after eliminating this effective metric that you get the action of the form, that we get the action in this form of m times length. But for massless particles, you are not allowed to eliminate it. The way you would eliminate would be different. So actually, for massless particles, you would stop a bit behind. The useful action is the one that you have x dot squared over the Hilbert. Okay?
Yeah, okay, but so these massless particles are not on shell, right? Because if they were, the length would be zero.
Right, right. You sum over all possible paths. You don't sum over the paths that that are the paths, you don't sum over straight lines between points. You sum over all possible paths, also for the massive particle. But, I mean, yeah, okay. Very good. So, then we wanted to understand what could be the dual, what could be the way of computing these Wilson loops that we saw in perturbation theory are the same in n equals 4 and in QED to the living order, and then there are different corrections, because then in nanabillion gauge theories, as you saw yesterday in the tutorial, I mean, you don't need to see in the tutorial, it's obvious. You have vertices of the gluon, so you can have very complicated interactions. So you have a vertex, you can have loops of gluons, you can have all this stuff. So this is, in general, you need to sum overall diagrams. And this is basically a huge mess. And this is what the expectation value of the Wilson loop for this contour would be. In particular, you might ask, what does it become when the coupling is very large? And here, for the theories which have a dual, we are going to use a DSCFT. So let me remind you what is the prescription for computing these loops. And we can justify this prescription from two different points of view. On the one hand, it's really the only reasonable thing you could draw. On the other hand, it actually is the most natural thing once you think where it came from. So the prescription, let me first tell you the prescription, and then let's try to hand wave and to argue why could it be the correct prescription. And of course, this is not something trivial, I must say. I mean, when people proposed the ADS-CFT conjecture, it was not, if you look at the original paper by Juan Malacena, it's not like he proposed the duality and then wrote an appendix with a dictionary with all quantities worked out. Of course, then it's a lot of work of lots of people trying to understand how each quantity can be computed using ADS-CFT. And in fact, it took him 1 year to propose this duality that we are now studying. And what he proposed is the following. You have z equals 0, which is the boundary of antidesiter, and then you have the radial direction z. So this is in this Poincaré coordinate, ds squared, which is dz squared plus dx mu over z squared. So you have this boundary. And what you are supposed to do is study the minimal surface, the open string that ends on this boundary and stretches inside the bulk of ADS. And this will give some minimal area. And the claim is that the expectation value of the Wilson loop is exponential of square root lambda over 2 pi times this area. Now, first of all, again, remember that the loop is an observable in the gauge theory. So of course, this boundary here is R4, or Minkowski 4, but here I already did a weak rotation, it's R4, it's the boundary. This is where the gauge theory lives. So the loop that I drew there is the loop we want to compute. And now I want to compute something in ADS. Of course, it must be something that ends on this loop. The most natural thing is to consider the minimal surface ending on this loop. Now, let me remind you why this is the most natural thing. Remember how we argued that there should be some sort of dual description of strings moving in a background. We said that if we have some particle moving in the presence of some brains, you sum over all possible interactions with this brain. You see here I could have another small bump inside and so on. You sum over all possible interactions of these particles with this brain, and this is equal to studying the movement of this string in a non-trivial background. And what is this background? This background is ADS5 times S5. Okay? And let me remind you that this distance here, if this is r equals 0 and this is r equal infinity, okay? And this is r equal infinity where we send stuff, let me remind you that z is L square over r, so z is equal to 0 here, and z is equal to infinity here, where the brains originally were, and now we replace them by a background. So this was the original argument. So this was what? Lecture 2, right? Or 3. So now, what do we have? One more important point. Remember that it was not just one brain. It was a stack of many brains. Okay? Now what do we have? Now we have the same picture. We have our stack of brains. Again, I'm just repeating an argument that I gave last time, but some of you said it was a bit fast, so I'm repeating it slower. You have a stack of brains, and you want to study the movement of a very heavy particle. You want it to be very heavy because you want to fix a classical contour. The contour is it's a function of this contour, this Wilson loops. You fix the contour, so you don't want the contour to vibrate. It's really some classical contour. And then you study all interactions sourced by this classical source. Right? This is like a classical source that moves, and then it emits gluons, and they interact quantum-mechanically, and we compute this expectation value. So we want to put a very heavy particle moving in some contour. So what can we do? If the strings end on the same brain, these strings are very light. They have m equals 0, because they have no tension, they are not stretched. So what we do to create a very massive particle in string theory, to create a very massive open string, as usual, is we separate one of the brains, just one, so it's very light, it doesn't back react on the geometry, and now we have an open string that is very heavy. So, and this mass can be very heavy. In particular, if we take it very, very far away, it goes to infinity. Then we consider the path described by this particle. This would be our Wilson loop. So this is the contour that appears in the Wilson loop. Now, what will this particle do? What will this particle do? It goes here and so on. And when it is here, interacting with this part, right, you can have any possible interaction of this string with this stack of brains, exactly like here. You had this open string and you could interact in many, many ways with the brains, and this would generate the large N expansion. In the same way here, you have just one boundary and it interacts with the lower part. You sum over all possible ways of interacting with the lower part, with one boundary, two boundaries, and so on. And that is exactly the sum over boundaries here. So it's exactly the same. It's exactly the same sum over all possible interactions with the brain. But then we know what it does. You just fix. Now let's draw. Let's remember this is z equals 0. We fix some boundary at z equals 0. And then it stretches. But instead of interacting with the brain, we can trade it by moving in ADS5. And this is just this picture upside down, of course. Okay? So again, it's not a very solid argument. It's just a picture for how we could have guessed. We knew it should be some sort of open string ending on a contour. This was just a way of guessing where to put the contour. It should be at the boundary, but of course the gauge theory lives at the boundary. So again, it's more or less the only natural thing, but it's very subtle. And actually, we will see, maybe not today, but certainly tomorrow, that actually, strictly speaking, this prescription does not compute the Wilson loop that I wrote, but a slightly generalized version of that Wilson loop, which is called a supersymmetric Wilson loop. And you could already anticipate that indeed there's something fishy about this, because this string that is pushing these brains, right? You can think of this endpoint like it's interacting with the brain, right? And this endpoint, it has a charge, right? The endpoints of strings have charge, right? So it interacts with a gauge field, right? I mean, that's the definition of charge, right? Interacts with a gauge field. But you also have a string, so you also push the brains, right? And you have a string also pushing the brains. So it should also interact not only with the longitudinal degrees of freedom, but also with the transverse degrees of freedom, which are the scalars, which were what became the scalars in n equals 4. So it's a bit strange that we are saying that this computes something which is an interaction of a particle with a gauge field. Why doesn't it also couple to the scalars? Why doesn't it also interact with the scalars? Why only with a gauge field? And indeed, we will see that it really is the dual of a slightly general Wilson loop that also couples to those scalars. But actually, at strong coupling, it doesn't make any difference. But okay, I'm jumping ahead. I just want to say that it's quite an untrivial task to guess what the dictionary could be. And actually, this description, I'm borrowing it from Aldesina from 98, and what he actually proposed was a dictionary for how to compute these supersymmetric Wilson loops. And actually, you see, to this was 98, the prescription for computing really our honest Wilson loops only came in 2007, 10 years after ADS-CFT, the correct prescription for computing general Wilson loops. Okay, for now, let's suppose we did not have this insight of thinking why is it not coupling to the scalars, and let's go on with this, which actually is correct, because in the large lambda limit, that doesn't make any difference.
What do you mean by this correct prescription for computing the Wilson loop?
So here I'm discussing ADS. I'm not telling what are the appropriate boundary conditions in the sphere. And that turns out to be quite a subtle business. And different prescriptions will correspond to describing Wilson loops with the scalars turned on or without the scalars turned on. Very good. But, so let's then move on, and let's compute, therefore, using ADS-CFT, let's compute this quark-antiquark potential. That is, what we want to study is, we have our boundary of Ante de Sitter, z equals 0. We put our Wilson loop to be 2 lines separated by r. Okay, this distance here is this very large t, and we want now to study this minimal surface to start seeing if it all makes sense. Do we get something that is something reasonable, right? Suppose I get cosine of r to the power r over 4, and certainly something very wrong, right? I mean, we better get something more or less reasonable. So let's see that everything comes out okay and that this is a very good prescription. Okay, so what's the starting point for computing this minimal area? Someone, what's the starting point? If you want more information both on the prescription and actually on this computation, this is in the original paper of Maldesina. So what's the way of computing the area? Well, if we want to study minimal surfaces in string theory, we better write the string action, right? So of course, the first step is to know what is the action that gives the area of a string, and that can be the Nambu-Goto action. So So the area, I mean, is just an Ambogato action, which is equal to square root of lambda over 2 pi integral over the world sheet. We can call this d sigma d tau, okay? And then, what do we have? We have the usual Nambu-Goto action that gives the area integral of the square root, sorry, of the determinant with respect to the world sheet index alpha and beta that take values sigma and tau of the metric GMN d alpha xm d beta xn, where this metric is nothing but this. So this is GMN d, now this is capital X, is the coordinate dxm dxn. So this X, capital X, in this coordinate is equal to small x and z. Okay? So this is the area that gives the area of a string in any background G. So you saw Nambu-Goto action, right? In Freddy's lectures. Yes? This I'm sure you did. So what is this action in these coordinates? So you see all elements of the metric contain 1 over z squared. So when I take the determinant, there is 1 over z to the 4 that I can take out and write as 1 over z squared. So square root of lambda over 2 pi integral, we know what the integral is over. Okay, but let's write d sigma d tau over z squared. So I took the z squared out. And now let's write it explicitly once so that there's no mystery what it is. So it's a 2 by 2 determinant. So tell me, what should I write in the first component? What are the first entry of this matrix? Sorry?
The sigma over the alpha and the sigma over the alpha.
No. Alpha and beta are the indices of this matrix, and they are all either sigma or tau. So what is the first entry of the
sigma x?
D sigma. So we have d sigma x. So we have, let's use, okay. So we have d sigma x dot d sigma x. So this x is the small x, it's the x that parameterizes the boundary, plus the same thing for z, plus d sigma z, d sigma z. Right? Then this one is the same, but with one sigma and one tau. D sigma x dot d tau x plus d sigma z, d tau z. This one is the same as this one. And this one is just sigma replaced by tau. D tau x squared plus d tau z squared. Yes? Is this clear? Very good. So now, luckily for this problem, we have lots of symmetry that we should explore. So of course this is parameterization invariant, this is really an area. So we can choose any useful parameterization. So what parameterization will we choose? We will choose, so this is z. This here would be our x as y. This is x. It's very cool when you can draw pictures in three dimensions. It's not always the case in string theory. But this is one example where you can really use x, y, z. And the very good parameterization is to use x and y as our parameters. So let tau be x. So it runs between, say, minus t over 2 and t over 2. And let sigma be, no, sorry, let tau be y and let sigma be x. And x runs between minus r over 2 and r over 2. What do we want to find then? Then, what is this vector x in this coordinate? This vector x is just x. which is sigma, y, which is tau, and the third direction in this boundary, which doesn't exist, which is zero. So that's what this vector x is. There are another one, and zero. And what is z? Well, z is a function z of what? What does z depend on?
Z.
On sigma. And z is just a function that just depends. It's just some function that depends on where we are here. Z of sigma. So we just plug this into this action. And we find, you see, let's see what we get. So the derivative of x with respect to sigma just gives 1. So it's the vector 1, 0, 0, 0 dotted with 1, 0, 0, 0. That's just a 1. Okay, so let's write down here. So this becomes a 1. This becomes just z prime square. Now we just functions of one variable, we can just use prime. This here becomes what? This one here. Guys, the sigma dot d tau of x. X is this. Someone else. Someone, what is the sigma of x dot d tau of x? X is here. Sorry?
Zero.
Zero. Right? I mean, the sigma is 1, 0, 0, 0. D tau is 0, 1, 0, 0. Zero. What about d sigma times d tau of z? Zero. I mean, sigma, z is a function of sigma only. What about dx tau, d tau x squared? What is d tau of x squared?
One.
One, right? What is d tau z squared? Zero, right? So it's a simple determinant to compute, no? So it is equal to square root lambda over 2 pi integral. Now notice, one of the integrals I can even do because nothing depends on time. So immediately I put time out here. And now I just have integral from minus r over 2 to r over 2 d sigma over z square square root of 1 plus z prime square. Okay? This is our action. Okay? Not so complicated, right? So it's a simple action for a variable of a single variable. I think we can, this is easy enough for us, right? So let's solve this system. Let's solve this. So what do you propose to do next? Now we know the action, what do you propose to do?
Conservation of energy.
Sorry?
Conservation of energy.
Yeah, you probably know this already, right? I mean, you probably studied this. No? You have a paper on quark anti-quark. It's not very easy. Of course it's conservation of energy, but it's not so obvious a priori. So naively you could think that you should write equations of motion, but indeed it's a slightly smarter way is to use the fact that this doesn't depend on sigma to write immediately the corresponding energy in quotation marks. And which is a constant. So of course, the action, the Lagrangian is independent of sigma. So the derivative with respect to of the Lagrangian with respect to z prime, let's just compute the energy times z prime minus the Lagrangian is equal to a constant. Again, of course, we can derive equations of motion and then integrate once and get this. But it's simpler to do it in this way. And that implies that 1 over z squared times square root of 1 plus z prime squared, if you just compute that, is equal to a constant. Okay, now, someone that did not study this before, how would you fix this constant? How would you fix this constant? So let's draw what we are computing. We have our shape. Right? This is r over 2, this is minus r over 2, this is sigma, and our goal is to study this function z of sigma. Okay? And the area is just t times this length there that we are interested in computing. Right? So the area is time times the length of this line. So what is that constant there? How can we relate it to some point in this curve. Well, any proposal? Any proposal how do you find this concept of integration? How do you do it, for example, when you throw a ball and you impose that the energy is conserved, and then the energy is constant, so it's equal to some constant, and then you want to find what's the value of this constant. You look to a particular point in the trajectory of the ball, which is quite simple, right? Which is the one where it is up there and the velocity stops, right? And then you say, oh, and this energy must be equal to mg times the maximum height, right? Remember? Well, it's exactly the same. So there is a point, which is the maximum height here, z naught. So at this point, this z prime is 0, so this constant is 1 over z naught squared. Okay, we just need to find this maximum point, z naught. And that's easy, because now that we have this, then this means that z prime is equal, so we just solve for z prime, it's equal to z naught to the 4 minus z to the 4 over z squared. Okay? So this is dz d sigma. So if we integrate, we know that the integral from minus r over 2 to 0, right, of d sigma, okay, of course it is r over 2, right? But on the other hand, it is equal to the integral from minus r over 2 to 0 of dz times 1 over z prime. Sorry, not minus r over 2 to 0. From 0 to h naught, right? So when you go from minus r over 2 to 0, z goes from 0 to h naught. So I start here and I go up to the maximum height, right? And you plug this integral for z prime. Sorry, I call it z naught. Sorry, z naught. You plug it there, you do this integral, and you find that this is just. So of course I can rescale z by z naught by dimensions, and then I get z naught times an integral of order 1, which is quite a nice integral. Integral from 0 to 1, z squared dz over square root of 1 minus z to the 4. Okay? So important point. This is a relation that tells that the radius and z, they are proportional to each other. Of course, they should be by dimensions. And the proportionality constant should be a number. And this number is 2 times this integral here. Okay? Yeah? So this integral is quite a nice integral. It gives quite a cute result, which is very famous in this ADS-CFT story. It gives a gamma of 1 quarter, so it gives square root of 2. Pi to the power of 3 halves over gamma to the 1 quarter to the power squared. So this is the result of this order 1 integral. Okay? It just turns out to be this. So this fixes z naught. So z naught is 1 half over this number, right? Okay, I don't need to compute z naught. So now that we know this, we can actually compute the area. And the area, what is it? It's the integral, this integral with d sigma. But we don't know z of sigma, but it's not a problem. We now change from sigma to z. We know z prime as function of z. So the area is the integral, or it's twice the integral, from 0 to z naught. Why twice? Because I'm covering only the first half. I integrate from 0 to z naught, I cover 1 half, then there is an equal contribution from the other side. Sorry, I forgot, the square root lambda over 2 pi from the string tension, a t from time. And then I integrate from 0 to sigma naught, so what do I integrate? Dz over z prime, this is just d sigma, then there was 1 over z squared, and then there was square root of 1 plus z prime squared. Okay? But now z prime as function of z naught, you know, so this becomes equal to t times 2 square root of pi over 2 pi. Now, I mean, you can check the factors of okay. Integral from 0 to 1 dz over z square 1 minus z square. So if there is no mistake, I hope there is not, this is what we get. So this is the area. Now there is a small problem with this integral. Can someone tell me?
Divergence.
Oh, we encountered this before. We should not be afraid of divergences if they are very simple, if they are just proportional to the length of the loop. Then we know that we can interpret them as mass renormalization. So what happens here is that indeed, if you go all the way to zero, there is a divergence, which is 1 over z. So if we replace this zero by epsilon, then this integral, it gives all this. It will give the following. It will give some constant over epsilon times t. And that will be actually, you see, so let me do it a bit carefully. So this z naught has dimensions. Here I want to put a cutoff. A cutoff should also have dimensions, but this z is dimensionless. So what I should put here for this to be, to have an idea. So if I want my cutoff to be, I have say 0 to r, and I want my cutoff to be some epsilon times r, okay, where r is my separation, then this cutoff would be something like epsilon times r over z naught. And when you compute this, you would see that you would get pi t over epsilon without any dependence on r, plus, actually the comment I just made was not important. Okay, forget about that, sorry. Minus, so this is what you get, minus 2, oh, sorry, please forget about this comment. So we just have this integral, we regularize by putting some epsilon, and we get minus 2 pi squared, square root of lambda, over gamma to the 1 quarter, times 1 over r. And this 1 over r just comes from this 1 over z naught.
So the divergence at z equals 1 doesn't make the...
z equals 1 is not not divergent. 1 over square root is integral.
Oh, yeah.
Z equals 1 is okay. But z equals 0, which is a divergence when you are approaching very much the boundary, is a divergence when you are approaching the boundary of the Wilson loop. It's exactly a divergence when you are close to the boundary, exactly like this kind of divergence is here. And indeed, these divergences, you interpret them, is a divergence. 1 over epsilon times t. T, you remember, is just the size, the length of this Wilson loop. So you interpret this 1 over epsilon times t as just length times 1 over epsilon. This is just a universal self-energy correction. If you want to study the force, which is the derivative with respect, there is t, of course. If you want to study the force, yes.
In this expression over area, should be square root of lambda or is square root of pi?
Yeah. Yeah. That's good. It's also a Greek letter. So you see that if you want to consider the potential, you read it exactly from here. So this is the potential that depends on R. Okay? So what did we find?
Pedro?
Yes.
In the second term, were we able to take the limit epsilon to zero already?
In the second term, yes. So this is just an expansion in the small letters. If you put an epsilon, so you have zero to R, and you put an epsilon, you cut off epsilon, then you get an expansion like that. So one term is proportional to 1 over the cutoff. So the potential must have units of 1 over r. But those units can be, you can soak those units either by 1 over cutoff or by 1 over distance. Right? That's the way you have 1 over units of 1 over distance, by either having 1 over cutoff or 1 over arc. And when you expand in cutoff, the first term has 1 over cutoff, the second has 1 over arc. The first one that has 1 over cutoff doesn't depend on arc, and we interpret it as self-energy. The second one we interpret as a potential, exactly like at weak coupling, exactly the same kind of divergence. So what do we find right now? What's our picture? Our picture is that as function of lambda, the potential, our quark anti-quark potential, what will it be? It will be minus some function that could depend on the toothed coupling over R. This form, the fact that we got a 1 over R potential is a very good sign because the theory is conformal. There are no other scales. The potential has units of 1 over R, so it must be 1 over R times some number. So it was good, actually, that from this computation of a minimal area, it came out to be just 1 over R without any subtlety, because it ought to be 1 over R. So this form is just fixed by conformal symmetry. There are no scales except R, and this has units of 1 over R. So this is just fixed by dimensions, or by conformal symmetry, or by scale invariance. But this function alpha can be a very non-trivial function. If we compute it at weak coupling, we know that we get the same as in QED, just a one-loop diagram. We get something like lambda over 2 pi, I think. This is when lambda is very large, well, very small. When lambda is very large, we get some behavior here. We get exponential. When lambda is very large for this constant alpha, we get that result there. Gamma of lambda, square root of lambda, times 2 pi squared over gamma to the 1/4. Didn't I forget powers? Yeah, I forgot. This gamma to the 1/4 is to the power 4. Gamma to the 1/4 to the power 4. They are different, but of course they should be different. One is computed at weak coupling, the other is computed at strong coupling. So how do we check it, the SCFT? Okay, maybe this is correct, but how do we check it? How do we know if this is true? We compute something at weak coupling, we compute something at strong coupling. Of course, what would be really cool is if we could compute this intermediate regime. And this is what we call an interpolation. Can we somehow find this quark anti-quark potential for any value of the coupling? Right? So can we find this interaction between a quark and an anti-quark in a gauge theory at any value of the coupling? Now, using the techniques we have seen so far, namely computing areas at strong coupling or doing Feynman diagrams at weak coupling, we cannot. We stay at strong coupling, we compute the area. What could be the next step? Consider fluctuations around the area, quantum fluctuations around the area, and try to compute the first correction to that result. Okay. Then two-loop correction, but that's already more or less hopeless. It's very hard. And at weak coupling, we could compute like two loops and three loops, and I think people did up to two or three loops. But then we are a bit in trouble. However, there is a new, very important player in this business, which is called integrability, which is the fact that actually this theory, called n equals 4 super young Mills, exhibits a property that basically translates into exact solvability in the large n limit. So this, it turns out to be possible to use two-dimensional techniques that I will explain next week to study some quantities in n equals 4 super young Mills at any value of the coupling. And then you might ask, can you compute such very physical quantity, the quark-antiquark potential, this function alpha of lambda, at any value of the coupling? So this was done 2 weeks ago, for example, by Amit Sever, Juan Maldacena, and Diego Correa. They managed to write, using this integrability approach, a set of equations that compute this function at any value of the coupling. So as I said, this was 2 weeks ago, by Diego Correa, Amit Sever, and Juan Maldacena. using exactly this integrability technique that we are going to discuss next week. So as you see, this is quite an untrivial subject. It's not like it was trivial to solve it before. Very good. So this is the quark-antiquark pattern. Any question?
But do they have an explicit function? Or?
They have. So this is solved in terms of an integral set, a set of integral equations. So in principle, if you plug those equations in a computer, you can solve it. So it's not as explicit as having a Bessel function or a cosine. Or it is a form of an integral equation. But some special functions at some point, they basically become defined by integral equations or differential equations and so on. So they solve by writing an integral equation, and there are lots of interesting points to explore and to generalize and to simplify. And even though they wrote a prediction for what this integral equation is, so they wrote this equation that is supposed to describe the spectrum of this alpha of lambda at any value of the coupling. So you would imagine, okay, the first thing they did was to check if weak coupling and strong coupling is okay. And they did. They expanded this equation at weak coupling, and perfect. The first three loops, tau, spot on, really perfect. At strong coupling, they don't know how to expand the integral equation. It's a complicated integral equation. So even to get from this integral equation this leading term should be there, because they conjectured this to be the full result. But no one was able yet, since these last 2 weeks, to compute this at strong coupling. Very good, but let's give them at least 2 more weeks. So now let's move to the point that I mentioned in the very beginning. Are we really computing these bosonic Wilson loops at strong coupling? After all, we know that the string that ends on the brain, it has charge, so it is very natural to couple to the gauge field, and that's what this path order exponential of a mu x dot mu dt does. But it also pushes on the brain. So you might ask, what about an interaction? Let's try to write something that could make sense. What about some interaction where you would have an integral over, let me, a mu depends on x, that depends on t. Suppose you have some scalar, phi I, that could depend on x and t, contracted with some theta, which is some vector that points in these 6 directions, theta I, that could depend on x and t. And then to make it parameterization invariant, let's put absolute value of x dot of t times dt. This would be reparameterization invariant. So why can't, isn't it natural to expect to have also something like this, something coupling to the scalar, since the open string that is not only charged, but also pushes the brain? And these scalars, I remind you, the 10-dimensional fields, the 4 gluons plus the 6 scalars, came precisely from the 10 possible polarizations of open strings ending on the brain, the ones responsible for longitudinal degrees of freedom and the ones responsible for transverse degrees of freedom. So isn't it natural to have something like that? Said differently, n equals 4 super young Mills, when you look at it, it smells like 10 dimensions, right? I mean, especially if you look at the fermions. I mean, there are gamma functions that you use normally in 10 dimensions. So it's not so natural to have a theory in 4 dimensions where you have these 16-dimensional gamma matrices. They are there because they came from 10 dimensions. And of course, this commutator of the scalars, it really looks like coming from f squared in 10 dimensions, and we know it. It's really what it is. So the theory smells very 10-dimensional, but our Wilson loop, our Wilson loop was not coming from the Wilson loop that you would write in 10 dimensions and then dimensionally reduce. If you would start with the Wilson loop in 10 dimensions, where you have AMXM, where this M would go from 0 to 9, and then dimensionally reduce, you would in principle get something like a combination of those two terms. So let's try to kill two rabbits at once, and let's try to find what would be, by the way, a nice coupling to these scalars that would make this object slightly better defined. That is, could we, since we are already putting the scalars will also have divergences of this sort. When 2 points are very close, there will be a propagator now of 2 scalars, and there will be a divergence because of the scalars. right? You think that you have a particle and you have self-energy interactions due to gluons and due to scalars. Let's put the interaction, let's design this interaction with a scalar guided by this principle that we want to get a well-defined object such that the divergence from the gluons cancels the divergence from the scalars. Let's try to kill these divergences completely and get a well-defined finite quantity that just depends on the contour. Okay? So how do we do it? It's very simple. For example, so we want to consider a loop where these divergences plus these ones, this is supposed to be the same loop, is equal to finite. So let's take this to be our goal, and tomorrow I will come back with another motivation for this object. But for now, suppose we are defining an object. It's our right to define whatever we want. We can define path order exponential with A or A with scalar. And since we are defining a new object, let's make it nice and let's make it finite. Okay? So for that, it's very simple. It is very simple. You just take this theta I to be a unit vector. Okay? And then consider the object, which is just the path order exponential of the gauge field I a mu x dot mu plus theta I, what do I want to write? Phi I times absolute value of x dot. And let's define this to be our Wilson loop. Let me show you why those divergences are killed. So now, it's like now we don't have the gluon, we have the gluon, but we also have the scalar. Let's call all these our, say, super field, super in the sense that it's bigger than just a field, not in any fancy sense, chi that depends on x of t. So it's just chi. Okay? And now, when we say that we have the propagator of the gluon plus the propagator of the scalar, this is just equal to this propagator of this field chi. So the expectation value of chi with chi, what is it? What is this propagator? Can someone tell me? So there is a propagator between scalars and a propagator between gluons. What should I write? You can start by numerator or denominator, whatever you prefer. Say denominator. What should I put downstairs? So let this point be x at t1 and let this point be x at t2. What should I put down there?
x2 minus x1.
Yeah, so this is just the distance x of t1 minus x of t2. Square. What should I put up here? Say from the gluons. From the gluons, remember, what did we do? We have two such gluons, and the propagator contains delta mu nu, so remember what we got. We got the inner product of the velocities, x dot at t1 dot x dot of t2. Yes? It's clear? And because there is an I there, there is a minus sign. So minus, and then x dot of t1 dotted with x dot of t2. This is from the gluons. What about the scalars? The scalars, the same story. Scalar with scalar gives what? So the propagator of two scalars is what? The propagator phi I phi j is of course delta I j over the same story. X minus y squared. So I just get delta function, I contract the thetas, but that gives 1. So I just get the product of the absolute value of the velocities. absolute value of x dot of t1 times absolute value of x dot of t2. Okay? So here we used that theta squared is equal to 1. And we used that there was this I and that I square is equal to minus 1. A very well designed balance, very well designed. And now you see what happens when t1 is equal to t2. When t1 is equal to t2, this becomes just the velocity squared, and this becomes x dot of t1 dot x dot of t1, which is also the velocity squared. So now this is finite as t1 or t2 approach t1. Okay? Basically, what is happening is the following. Is that if you think a bit from the 10-dimensional point of view, what kind of loop could give rise to this 10-dimensional loop? It would be a loop that in 10 dimensions is always locally null. And because the loop in 10 dimensions is always locally null, the divergence is what? Is the length times 1 over 8. But if a curve is null, it has length 0. So what happens is that from the 10-dimensional point of view, this object is finite because it's a loop that it's always, the tangent is always a null vector. So it's a locally null vector from the 10-dimensional point of view. But we are just defining it in 4 dimensions by this argument that we want to get a nice object. Now, this object here is finite, so we would like a candidate for what could be the dual of this object. So we would like now a proposal, and this was really the original proposal of the paper I mentioned up there, and here is the proposal. You compute the area. Now we need a dual for this finite Wilson loop. So this Wilson loop now for any contour is finite. It's a finite object, this supersymmetric Wilson loop. And we would like to write down what is the prescription for computing it in ADS-CFT. And the prescription is the following. Compute the area of a minimal surface that ends on a contour. Okay. Suppose you compute this area, and to regulate the divergences, you compute it and you cut it some epsilon away from the boundary. So now we know that this gives a divergence. But actually, it's a simple exercise that you are going to do in tomorrow's tutorial to understand what's the form of this divergence. So because you are going to do it, I will just do it by words now, so pay attention, please. Okay, let me write what the result is. The result is the following. The claim is that the divergence is subtracted if I subtract the following. It's the area of another minimal surface that starts in the same contour and then just goes straight up. And this is what is happening. And you cut again some epsilon of it. And you just consider the area of this surface sigma minus the area of this surface that goes up forever, sigma naught. So it's very easy to see that this is correct. Let's see what this area that depends on sigma naught does. So what is this surface here? Let's just see what this surface is. This is the surface which is parametrized by where z is just equal to time in all points, it just goes up. And so z can be just equal to tau, and these coordinates x are just x of sigma. You agree? This is just specify x of sigma, and then z is just tau. This is what this is in this coordinate. You specify some loop, and then the loop doesn't move, doesn't depend on tau. Yes? So what is the Nambu-Goto action for this solution? The area for the Nambu-Goto action, again, this is exactly asked to do in the tutorial, so we can do it a bit fast. So what is the area? We plug the solution there, Let's see again. The first term there, so let me do it fast. This first term gives x dot square, right? X sigma dot square. The d sigma doesn't contribute in this case. Here, no one contributes. And down here in the corner, d tau doesn't contribute. And d tau of z gives 1. So we get just integral. So d tau I can replace by z. Dz over z square times integral d sigma square root of x prime square. Square root of lambda over 2 pi. This guy starts at epsilon and goes to infinity. This one is some contour, say from 0 to 2 pi, for example. So we see what we get. This area here gives just minus 1 over epsilon, or 1 over epsilon. And what does this give? Well, this is nothing but the length of the loop. Yeah? Is it correct? So you see that the divergence just comes from the boundary z equal to 0. This is where the divergence comes from. Close to that boundary, the divergence is a 1 over epsilon divergence. We see it from here. And we also see that it's proportional to the length of the loop. Of course, this behavior close to the boundary is the same here. Locally, if only it matters is z equal to 0, the two solutions are the same, and you conclude that the divergence here is exactly of this form. Yes? So if you subtract these two, you really totally kill the divergence. So let's call this, I don't know, some curly area to denote that it's the regularized area. This is what people normally call regularized area. And then the conjecture is that, take, say, this unit vector that needs to be unit to be, say, a constant. 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, for example. Then, the conjecture is e to the minus square root of lambda over 2 pi times this curly area is equal to the expectation value of this supersymmetric Wilson loop where you integrate a plus theta I phi I. As you go to strong cup. Now, as I said, that strong coupling, it doesn't make any difference. At strong coupling, the supersymmetric Wilson loop or the Wilson loop give the same. And this is actually something that was better understood last year by a paper of Polchinski and Sully, and also in 2007 by Maldesen and Aldai. But basically what happens is that if you choose something like that, it's like the string is pointing in one direction in the sphere, and the motion in the sphere is trivial. It's just a point in the north pole of the string of the sphere, and it doesn't have any area and it doesn't contribute. But the claim, the strong claim, is that this object here is really an exact duality that goes beyond lambda going to infinity. The claim is that if you would start studying quantum fluctuations of this Wilson loop, if you would take the shape of this Wilson loop and start considering this all the possible quantum fluctuations of this Wilson loop, you would start going from this large lambda regime, going a bit inside, and you could compute loops with this prescription. And similarly, if you and in principle, if you could define by exponential of the area, I mean the string path integral with the appropriate boundary conditions to end on this contour. That's what I mean by this. At lambda very large, it is just the area. Otherwise, you have all the possible quantum corrections. Okay. Very good. So tomorrow, what we will do is, so now we have this definition of this object, this super loop. It's a fun object because, I mean, all this, we don't have to deal with ultraviolet divergences anymore. It's a finite object. We have a prescription for what it should be. And now we are going to try to do a computation with this Wilson loop, this natural Wilson loop, where the string couples to the scalars and to the scalars and to the gluons. This one really looks 10-dimensional in nature, and this looks like something where we might be lucky. And indeed, we will be very lucky. We will see that in that case, we will study the simplest possible contour, which is not a rectangle, but is what? A circle. And when we will study a circle, we will see that we will be able to draw a complete curve between weak and strong coupling. There, we will do the strong coupling, the weak coupling, but we will also do the any coupling computation. Okay? So that's the goal for tomorrow. And that will be the first time we will see an interpolation in ADS-CFT between weak and strong coupling. And we will see that the gauge theory, a gauge theory computation done purely within gauge theory, if you go and see what it gives at strong coupling, it matches exactly what it should match, which is really highly remarkable, if you want, seeing strings emerging from gauge theory. That's it, I think, for today. Any question?
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
So in the circular Wilson loop, does it give us the Pascal result?
Yes. So this result, the way I'm going to do it will be in a very pedestrian way. But again, so I'm going tomorrow to explain you a derivation that was done, if I remember correctly, in 2001 or 2002. In 2007, the result that I'm going to show tomorrow was derived. So again, it took quite a few years till people developed the appropriate techniques to study finite coupling. And in that case, these techniques are not integrability, but are what is called localization. So right now, there are two very powerful tools in gauge theories that are very often explored in the context of ADS-CFT and not only in ADS-CFT, and they are integrability and localization. And in these lectures, I will describe a lot integrability. I am not an expert in localization, but there are many experts at PI. You can ask Jaume, Simone, many people at PI that can answer everything you might want to know. More questions? So you see, the business here is computing minimal surfaces in anti-de-Sitter. And very simple geometrical thing to do. That's what we are doing now. No? Was it a bit fast? Was it okay? Okay, very good. Again, please do tell me if I'm going fast or something.